Welcome to the DebtWire podcast. I'm your host, Madalina Jakob, co-managing editor of DebtWire North America. I'm glad to be joined today by two distinguished guests, Zul Jamal and Barak Klein, co-heads of U.S. Capital Structure Advisory at Moelis. Barak has over 25 years of investment banking and asset management experience, advising clients on liability management, Chapter 11 reorganizations, debt financing transactions, and distressed M&A. He has also held senior-level roles in asset management and in restructuring and recapitalization, in addition to working at a hedge fund for 5 years. Zul has over 25 years of investment banking experience, specializing in complex in-court and out-of-court lender negotiations and distress financing. He has worked with companies, creditors, and acquirers across a wide range of industries. Zul and Barak, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
So you've known each other and worked together for a long time. Can you take us back to how you first started working together and how that relationship evolved over time?
Zul and I met actually in University of Pennsylvania. Zul was friends with a lot of guys in my fraternity, and we would hang out in the frat house back in the day. And then we ended up just working together at Jefferies. It was like 10 of us in the back of office because Jefferies was starting its New York office. And from there, we worked together. And through the entirety of our junior banking years, we worked together on a whole bunch of different assignments. I left for the buy side. Zul stayed and he went to London for a couple of years. And then when the teams went to Moelis, I rejoined and we'd been working together ever since 2009. So it's been a long time together and a lot of history.
In this industry, it's known for frequent turnover, but many Moelis restructuring bankers have stuck together and you two are a great example. This is just an amazing accomplishment. What was the secret ingredient that kept this partnership so tight?
I think it's more than a partnership because in addition to the two of us, a number of our colleagues, as you note, have worked together for a long time. I think it is really a testament to the team that came over to Moelis. And then the team at Moelis, since we've added people, has also at the senior level had relatively little turnover. And I think it's because we like working together. We really view ourselves as a team in terms of our success is not really individual success. It's really a team success. And culturally setting ourselves up to empower the people that are coming up through the organization, doing good work for clients, and being supportive of each other's careers, I think has stood us all in good stead. And I think that's why so many of us have stayed together.
I think culture is generally self-select. We talk about it like, the culture, but the culture is really important. We are, as Zul said, we are super team oriented. And I think that self-selects the people who are into it for the team. And I think we've been able as a group to sustain that for couple of decades.
And I do think being at Moelis, where the firm prides itself on the sort of one P&L model, we're all working together as a firm. The fact that our team operates that way fits very well into how the firm thinks of itself and how the firm likes to approach situations. And it's why we end up with not just close relationships with our team, but if you look at the industry bankers that we work with a lot and the coverage bankers, they're as much a part of our success as our team is because we have such a good collaborative relationship with them. And for many of them have had that relationship going back to when all of us started at the firm together.
Very interesting. And when did you first realize that this partnership work also under stress, not just when deals are flowing?
So I think it comes back to what we've already talked about is sometimes one or the other of you will be doing well or not doing well. Maybe you've won a couple of pitches. Maybe someone else has lost a couple of pitches or a deal is being particularly difficult. If you are not team focused and you are just focused on your own individual accomplishments, that can really get you down. And I think when I've had a tough run, generally others in the team have been doing well and being able to be invested in that success and viewing that as much a part of your success as your own individual accomplishments, I think really helps get through the ups and downs that are natural in any banker's career. Sometimes you'll be doing well, sometimes it'll feel like nothing's going right, but being grounded in the long term, if we keep doing a good job, we'll all lift each other up together, I think generally helps moderate some of those tougher moments.
Is there a particular, like an anecdote, a moment that you might remember?
You have to have, as Zul said, invested in the partnership in terms of everybody's success. You also have to trust each other to do the right thing and be able to handle everything that comes with this job, which is not the easiest. And I think if we go back to COVID, where we were just catching whatever was falling our way, and really there was only a handful of us who could manage at that level, we had to have an immense amount of trust across us, the firm trusting and us trusting in the firm, because the volumes were just ginormous. So we had daily calls trying to track through everything that we were handling. But ultimately, we had to make sure that everybody was full ramped and that everything was getting handled correctly, because I think one of the other things in terms of our culture is good outcomes matter. And we pride ourselves on having good outcomes, and we're not just trying to push the deals across. So with that, you have to be able to trust your partner in creating good outcomes for your clients.
Since you have so much experience, what did restructuring look like early in your career versus today? And what would surprise a junior banker now?
So I think restructurings have changed pretty significantly, primarily because the capital structures have evolved from capital structures that were light on secured debt and heavier on unsecured debt to ones where they are extremely heavy on secured debt and there is little or no unsecured debt in the structure. So that changes the types of transactions that you can pursue. It changes companies' operating flexibility in bankruptcy. It changes companies' ability to attract new financing. At the same time, the secured debt that we see today in many ways behaves like the unsecured debt that used to exist 25 years ago. If you think back when I got into the business, the secured debt layer was really bank debt driven. You didn't have as many, if any, CLOs. Leverage loans weren't really a thing. It was really about high yield bonds, and maybe you'd have secured high yield or unsecured high yield. And you still talked about subordinated debt and senior subordinated debt. None of those things are really that prevalent anymore. And so companies' room to maneuver was much greater, particularly when it came to securing financing and operating in bankruptcy. So you saw a lot more bankruptcies that were what we would now term freefall bankruptcies, where companies filed, affected operational change, presented a business plan, and only then would you have a negotiation about the restructuring.
Delever the balance sheet.
Yeah, you can't afford to do that. You have so much secured debt. There's so much more cost. Very hard to just kind of go into bankruptcy with no plan, affect operational change, and then figure it out. The lenders wouldn't tolerate it, and the costs of administration wouldn't tolerate it.
You go back, I remember when we were starting, it was maintenance covenants in the bank debt, right? And that just doesn't exist anymore. We don't even think about maintenance covenants and secure leverage loans or anything. Remember, we had rolling EBITDA covenants, for
100%.
Right? And all that stuff is gone. And so I think it's just a very different, the structures have manifested itself very differently than where we were, mainly because originators have been able to get away and issue debt with covenant light and the rest.
And I think if you think about the participants in restructuring 25 years ago, it was the banks at the top of the structure, and it was the actual banks in many cases. And then the layer below that was the high yield investors, which were the high yield bond mutual funds. And then there was a very active secondary market of distressed hedge funds that would buy that debt as it got to distress level, many of whom have now become the big fund managers of today. And if you look at today, the big drivers of transactions are the big CLO managers, big asset management complexes that have big CLO vehicles. And you don't have as much of the debt turning over into secondary hands across a wide range of investors. You have some very large repeat players in that world. But for the most part, a lot of deals today are negotiated with the original buyers inside of those CLO vehicles. Because again, for the most part, we're talking about leveraged loans as opposed to bonds, although you still do have a fairly robust high yield bond market. It's just become a lot less relevant on a relative basis to the loan market.
I remember when Aurelius would get into the bonds, right? We would find out at that wire that they bought this huge chunk. We knew that there has to be some play because they like to look into documents and find some loopholes in the documents. And now you don't have stories to say, oh, this distressed hedge fund has bought this big position and it has an agenda and let's find out what's the game theory here.
It comes back to the fact that the structures have become so secured heavy with unsecured or second lien, what have you, because the price at which the debt trades is very hard to get overly creative because you have such a large tranche that you have to deal with. There's only so much embedded leverage in the purchase to create something that's valuable with convexity. That's really fundamentally the structural change. If you have huge first lien leverage layer, that is effectively the entirety of the enterprise value. Convexity is just moving with the entirety of the enterprise value instead of some type of leverage. And I think that's taken certain players out of the market, people who like to swing a little bit more, and has created more debt-like features of restructuring complex.
And I do think, by the way, the other thing that you have had happen when you move from bonds to loans, and you noted it, it used to be figuring out who was buying and who owned it, even as the issuer, was opaque. But you didn't have control over who bought your bonds, and you often couldn't find out who was the owner of your bonds until they decided to raise their hand. But with the leveraged loan universe, the issuer has basically full transparency, setting aside participations that may be done, but they have basically full transparency as to who all of their lenders are. And they have some control over who those lenders are. You have DQ lists, you have approval over assignments. And so not only has the playing field changed, but the control the issuer has over the participants in that game has also increased pretty significantly from the bond heavy structures that we saw 20 plus years ago.
Well, that's really changed the balance of power in restructuring, basically. Yeah.
I think that has, when you combine it with the very flexible documents that lenders have agreed to, given the makeup of the structural makeup of the new issue universe, that those two things have really given issuers a lot more leverage than perhaps they used to have.
I also think funds and how they're billing themselves in terms of fundraising has also changed. I think the ability to raise money to invest in debt, LPs have really gravitated towards that versus equity, post-reorg type returns. And I think that's changed the incentive for people across the board. As post-reorg equities have not performed well, it's very hard for funds to go out and raise. And there's only a handful more focused on that than trying to just buy debt. And then it happens to be restructuring instead of buying into restructuring to own the equity on the back end.
You said that in the past, restructuring often culminated with a Chapter 11 where you would deleverage and perform operational changes. When did you first notice that more outcomes were being sold out of court with Chapter 11s becoming more expensive?
I think it's a misnomer that things were not solved out of court. I think they've always been solved out of court. All of the tools that are now being used in liability management exercises are all tools that have existed for 30 to 40 years. I think the big difference is that used to be that those were done with bonds, and because you have securities laws, you have to run these exchange offers, and there's more,
public.
There's more publicity, they're more complicated. Whereas with loans, being able to do them privately, you can do them much more efficiently. So I don't know that the number of out-of-court transactions has necessarily increased proportionately. I think what we have seen happen, though, is the types of out-of-court transactions have morphed to ones where, because, to Barak's earlier point, the investor universe is much more debt focused, and a lot of the vehicles that own the debt are moreover structured vehicles that are heavily debt focused, the motivations of creditors has shifted alongside the motivations of issuers. And so the securing new money, extending maturities, perhaps capturing discount, all of that done out of court has become much more prevalent. And the ultimate equitization or deleveraging event is either delayed significantly or it doesn't happen because none of the parties around the table view that as the optimal outcome from their particular seat that they're in. The sponsor doesn't want to lose control, or if they do, they want to wait as long as possible. The investor would much rather have debt as currency than equity, given the makeup of their investment. and downside.
You mean CLOs, let's say, right?
CLOs, yeah. And by the way, funds as well, and protecting your downside by getting the documents to reflect limited flexibility from documents that had maximal flexibility becomes the critical driver, as opposed to creating an investment by buying debt at a discount to then take ownership of the equity of a company at the bottom of its cycle or its operating performance. While that still happens, it's just the weight of transactions has moved much more to the former than the latter, given the particular motivations each of those parties have.
It's grown with the sophistication of the market, right? You can go back to CLO version 1.0. They couldn't even put up money in debt to protect themselves. They had a workout person, but it wasn't a totally dedicated workout person sometimes. And so I think as we have gone through, I think we're probably on CLO 3.0 docs. They've also attracted talent in that transactional spot. I call it a workout spot, but it's more transactional spot because they're also involved in some of the underwriting. And that personnel and that talent has elevated, and that has increased creativity in many respects, and also understanding the broader perspective of what they're trying to accomplish. And so I think that sophistication level has increased. The ability to use the technology has increased of creating out-of-court transactions. And that's naturally landed for a whole host of reasons, sponsor wanting to retain control, et cetera, them wanting debt, in a spot where it's very viable to create transactions that get everybody what they want. And I don't think that would have happened absent the maturation of some of these funds and attracting forward-thinking personnel.
We talked about discounts and these out-of-court transactions. We just didn't use the name that's overused, like liability management. Zul mentioned it's been done forever. It's just that it became more prevalent recently. But when it comes to LMEs, people often focus on cooperation agreements, on baskets, on mechanism, new technology you mentioned, Barak. What do you think is the most important strategic decision that really determines if an LME works or fails?
From whose perspective?
I guess you're right.
Our business is 70% company, 30% creditor. We're in the middle of both, which we like. You need time to an event, be able to craft the best transaction. And I think we both think 2 to 3 years out is probably the sweet spot. And then you get to the baskets, because the world is, whether we like it or not, it's built on carrot and stick approach. I can give you this, and if you don't, I'm going to hit you with this. And like the inherent baskets are available, super important. The convexity of the asset, meaning what I say is like the upside downside ratio of the asset itself, is important, and how over leveraged in certain circumstances things are, so that the creditors are either fearful and want to transact because the value only runs so far. That's an aspect that is important. And then it's really the personalities who are on the ground. Not every fund acts the same. Not every person within a fund acts the same. Certain people have their own predilections of what they want to have happen, or what type of transactions they feel good about. And if you know the personalities on the other side with the other factors that I listed, you can craft certain things. That all goes into what I call the blender. And what spits out is like the good outcome, right? And that's how we view ourselves and judge ourselves.
Why is investors' composition so critical to outcomes?
Because all of these are geared around a coalition of the willing, right? If you need a maturity, it's different. But if you're trying to open a basket or incentivize people to follow a group or come into a transaction, you need to get to a certain requisite percentage. And how those parties interact amongst themselves and with you is super important. On some level, it comes down to trust as well. As we talked about earlier, trusting your partners, but also you have to have enough credibility around the horn to get people to move towards this transaction. So I think personalities matter. Otherwise, this could totally be replaced by AI, which I don't think is going to happen.
Since you are advising both lenders and the companies, from the company's perspective, what are the real risks of being too aggressive, even if the transaction is fully permitted under the doc?
So I think the biggest, two biggest risks you have, one relates to the transaction at hand, where sometimes if you're too aggressive, the response can be equally aggressive and each party can go off into their corner, and then ultimately getting to a deal is very difficult or made much more complicated. So sometimes the threat of the aggressive deal is more powerful than actually moving down the path of doing the deal itself that then creates the mess. Because ultimately, those deals away tend to make capital structures messier. And so it's rarely the optimal outcome. It's more the outcome that you will do if you can't reach a deal with your existing lenders for the most part. And if you are too aggressive as an issuer, you can push the lenders to respond equally aggressively with litigation or other things that just become costly and a distraction for the operations of the business. At the same time, if the lenders are too aggressive, they can also push the issuer to do things that are detrimental ultimately to the lender's value by doing that deal. And so being able to show each other that you can be aggressive is a tool that everyone will use to try and bring people ultimately together. So that's in the deal itself. And then more broadly, there is the concern around if you become known as a company or a sponsor that is always aggressive, counterparty behavior could change when they interact with you. We really haven't seen the BSL market not provide financing to sponsors. It's not clear to me there's really been a premium that any sponsor has had to necessarily pay based on their behavior, but that's always the fear. And I think particularly as we look at private credit becoming a bigger and bigger percentage of the market, and because many of the private credit lenders are also the large lenders in the BSL world, there I do think it has affected lender behavior. And as that world merges and crosses over more and more, perhaps it will start to impact how BSL lenders will think about issuers. I don't know that it has yet because there's so much market depth, but that would be the sort of broader macro concern.
I think if you're consistently overly aggressive, you will wear some backlash. And you've seen that in certain circumstances where even upon the drop of a rumor of the company hiring somebody, there's a 95% co-op before anything happened. And I think that is somewhat of a reputational wear based on how people have acted in the past.
What do companies often underestimate about lender behavior and vice versa? What do lenders misunderstand about company incentives? I'm curious, since you are on both sides of the advisor.
So I think that one thing lenders often underestimate is the complexity of decision-making on the company side, because they just often assume if it's a sponsor-owned company that it's effectively one voice, but that's really not the case because you have multiple constituencies inside of the sponsor. You have the deal team, you have the investment committees, you have the capital markets people, you have senior management, and then you have the actual management team of the business itself that may have a greater or lesser voice depending on the circumstance. When you expand that to include public companies, you then have the complexity of a public company board where it's not nearly as obvious as a sponsor in terms of the behavior. And I think lenders often underestimate that there are numerous competing interests, even on the company side, in terms of driving to a deal and what matters and what's important. And one thing may be important to a certain constituency inside of that set of actors, and some things may be less important. Everyone, I think, tends to understand that, you know, when you have a complex lender group, you have 10, 15 institutions, there's that complexity. And they will often wave away the complexity of the issuer and just treat it as a monolith. And I don't think that's necessarily the case at all. I think there's complexity and a push-pull on the issuer side as much as on the lender side.
I think these deals all come down to prioritization, right? There's something that's going to have to happen. And the question is, can you get both sides' prioritizations to at least line up and match so that what someone cares about, the other one doesn't care about it so much, and vice versa, right? I think that's the whole game. And I think both sides just need to continue to recognize that. And I think in each of these negotiations, they're searching for where that common ground could exist. And I think each situation is a little bit different. But the goal, our goal, is getting to the right outcome, regardless of who we're representing. We represent a company on company side, a lender on lender side, getting to the right answer for our clients. And I think that has to do with prioritization and understanding how the other side is involved.
I also think that both lenders and issuers will often get anchored to or bogged down on precedents and comparable transactions as the basis for decision-making because it's a world that everyone in the industry is used to, right? When you're pricing a new issue, you'll look at where similar companies are trading. When you're valuing businesses, you'll look at comps, you'll look at precedent transactions. And so gravitating toward what happened in the last 10 deals, what happened in the last 50 maturity extension trades, how much money were people able to raise? People will always ask about data points. And I think that while those can be useful, the misnomer is that you can treat those data points similarly to how you would treat pricing benchmarking for a new issue where it's exceedingly informative, when in reality, why certain transactions took the form that they did and created the result that they did is often very much more situation specific in restructuring and liability management world than it is in raising new money for a new issue or even valuing a business compared to a bunch of other businesses, because the facts and circumstances are so different deal to deal. And because you have companies that are under some degree of stress, if not distress, what's going on inside of those enterprises is vastly different in many cases, situation to situation. And so there's a risk that you can get anchored to or gravitate towards comps as the basis for both your negotiations as well as your expectations. And it can lead to either a more difficult negotiation or a missetting of expectations by both parties as to what the right answer is for this particular transaction.
That is 100% correct. And it's a very important point. These situations are very unique. You're structuring very unique securities or asking for very unique things. And each situation is very different. And it comes down to, like I said, the prioritization. When people get anchored on precedence, because I did this in this transaction over here, that works until it doesn't. In the end, either we're going to transact, or we're not going to transact. And what happened over here doesn't really matter.
So yeah, I wanted to ask you if across the cycles, you've seen what is the mistake that people do again and again, and maybe this is one of them that they get anchored into these comps. But yeah, if you have an example of you think some mistakes that are done that people can learn from, or if you have on the opposite side, a positive example or a restructuring that you can talk about that you've worked on.
So I would say two mistakes, and this is a generalization, and they're not necessarily mistakes because often they are a function of the motivations of the parties. But people, I think, have generally speaking, tended to put more debt on companies than is optimal, because companies that are going through financial challenges often need more operating flexibility and more access to capital to fix their problems than the average company. At the same time, because as Barak had mentioned earlier, post-reorg equity has been such a challenging asset class, you can understand why people would like to put as much debt on companies as they can, because that form of recovery is more tangible and easier to monetize than getting a bunch of equity in a company that is reorganized. Now, one could argue that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because you end up with over-leveraged businesses and therefore they don't perform well, and therefore the post-reorg equity doesn't perform well, and it becomes this cycle. But I think that generally speaking, if you asked almost any market participant, they would say these businesses should have come out with less debt than they do. But because of the various motivations and constraints, you often can't. I'm not saying that they're over-levered, they just have more debt than they should. So that's, I'd say, point one. The other mistake or the other issue is these negotiations can often get very bogged down arguing over minutia points. And those arguments can sometimes take longer, cost more, and create more friction than the negotiations that have hundreds of millions of dollars of impact on enterprise value and recovery.
But like what, for example, what minutia points?
So how people argue about covenants on the debt that's being put in place on a post-restructured basis. How people argue around all of the various puts and takes of a warrant package and all the various provisions. They will torture themselves over the edge case 1% probability outcome and making sure that outcome will work out in their favor. Now, that overall, I think, ends up costing more money and creating very little value. Again, the counter to that, just like my first point, is the one time someone focused on it and it actually created a bunch of value, because there will be examples where a minutia point resulted in a return to one party or the other. which is why everybody finds it very hard to let go of what should be small issues, because everyone remembers the one time it resulted in a oversized return and not the 1,000 times it made no difference, because that's just how we're all wired to think. And so I think deals could be done much more efficiently if people would let things go and be more reasonable over issues that everyone knows don't matter that much. But it's a very hard behavior to change because everyone around the table is paid to be the smartest person in the room. And sometimes being flexible is viewed as being someone who's getting outsmarted.
I think there's two lessons. I think from the company side, start early. These negotiations can sometimes take various paths and you sometimes need to step away to come back. And you have to plan that in when you start thinking about when you want to start the process. And I know that's hard. That's sometimes the hardest part, getting companies started to get their heads wrapped around. You have less sponsors and usually the pub codes, but you're two and a half years out, you need to start thinking about this pretty rapidly. And 3 years is better than 2 years. And we've had cases where, take Carvana, for example, we had to step away for a bit and then come back to it. And we had enough time to do it. And we had everybody to do it.
It was an amazing transaction.
It's amazing. We got to the right transaction, both for the company and for the creditors. It was the right transaction for everybody, but that took time. And if we had started, who knows where the world would have been, but if we had started later, maybe we wouldn't have had the chance to step back.
Yeah. I remember when we were looking at it in the beginning and we thought it's going to be a restructuring.
Yeah.
And then it turned out it's a great example of successful out-of-court restructuring. What made that transaction so successful when you look at others? There you had an owner, right? It was not a sponsor. You had the family who owns.
So there's a couple things going on at the same time. We had flexibility. We had time. And the company was performing. So you had everything going up and to the right. And so it was very clear what we were prioritizing. And it was also very clear what they were prioritizing. And we were able to cross those actually pretty easily once we got to the right spot. But to get the chessboard set up so that you could actually have that negotiation to get people to yes, took some time. And it took us eight to 10 months to get there. But I think once the chessboard was set up right and the asset was in the right spot, we had very smart people, both on the creditor side and the company side, sitting across the table. And it was relatively easy to get done because it was the right deal for both. On the second part, though, I think to Zul's point, what I see people doing frequently is being too cute by half. And I think this whole I'm the smartest guy in the room really does bog things down. And I think the more people can get away with that and just get to the deal, the better it'll be.
We always had personalities in our restructuring world, but you feel like now we are, it's even...
I actually think we have fewer personalities, but you have more people trying to outsmart each other. Like when I got into the business, it felt like the personalities were loud. They were screamers. They used to threaten people. It was a different world. It was a world that was born out of bankruptcy court almost, where, and it was a lot of lawyers. I think now it's more investor types all just trying to outsmart each other.
I think that's right. If you look at people's backgrounds, they came from, they've grown up on the buy side now. They understand they're fighting for that last half point very hard. And that's what they've been tasked to do by their partners or their founders. And I get it. It's just a juice worth the squeeze type stuff. But ultimately, they've made that decision. That's where they want to take this. And we'll see over time as litigation bills pile up and all the rest of the stuff, we'll see where it goes. That's where people's sweet spots are. And people go back to their DNA. So one of the things, because we grew up at Jefferies, our DNA tends to be very capital markets-y. If you can see where our mindset comes from, our structuring, we were trained around capital markets issuance. We weren't really just trained around bankruptcy or anything like that. So like I said—
Trained to look for solutions.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's trained us well or whatever. It's been good training ground for us. And it's made us flexible in terms of whatever the solution set is, we can figure it out. And we've also been trained around bankruptcy law. Everyone in our group can testify. They've testified as experts in Chapter 11, which is not the most fun thing, but it's a skill set that you have to have if you want to get to the end game, right? And so I think all of those things have been super additive towards us.
So now if we zoom out a little bit from the company versus lender dynamic and just look at what the market is signaling more broadly right now. I just want to ask you a little bit about software, right? Because for years, software was viewed as one of the best credit investments. We had low defaults, strong cash flow, significant equity value. And I'm curious to see what you think about the current pressure in software. Do you think it's more about uncertainty about exit valuation equity cushions rather than about credit fundamentals?
I think that's right for the most part. I think what you really have seen is because of everything that is happening around the risk associated with AI on business in general, and because people have come to the realization that AI may have a dramatic impact on a vast swath of the SaaS marketplace, there's been a fundamental revaluing of all of those companies. I wouldn't say it's without regard as to how impacted they're going to be by AI or not, but you have seen a massive re-rating, in some cases fairly, in some cases probably unfairly. And it's mostly about refinancing risk and enterprise value in the future, as opposed to all of a sudden people woke up and said there's no cash flow. So I would contrast it. If we go back and think about the great financial crisis, for example, where you had a dislocation in the economy and you had a bunch of cyclical businesses all of a sudden have to restructure, it was because fundamentally their demand dried up and their earnings power collapsed rapidly. I'm thinking chemicals, metals, building products, et cetera. Software hasn't had that happen where all of a sudden everyone woke up and a bunch of software companies have lost lots of contracts, but rather people are sitting there saying, these businesses used to be worth 20 times EBITDA or some multiple of ARR. And now with everything that's going on, how should we think about what multiple this business will sell for 3 years from now when my debt matures? No one knows the answer to that question. And so it's a challenge of, is this company going to be worth the debt? Is it going to be worth less than the debt? Is it going to be a business that has a long tail, a short tail? And these questions are questions with, it's not even like what I'll call the evolution that we saw in media, right? Where it used to be that we were a world of newspapers, magazines, yellow pages, radio, and television. Those businesses 25, 30 years ago were fantastic cash flow monopoly businesses. The local newspaper was a great business that you could add a lot of leverage to. And then Craigslist came along, disintermediated, and those businesses have slowly gone from being great businesses to becoming okay businesses to becoming businesses that in many cases, like Yellow Pages, no longer exist. And I think people look at software and have some of the same fears. I don't know that anyone knows yet how to pick exactly the winners and losers, which is why you've seen this broad sell-off. And also, while there was a lot of equity in these deals, and so you may have a business that's 7 or 8 times levered, but it has 8 turns of equity invested in it. It wasn't that it was a 50% loan to value deal when it went to market. The problem is the day after the deal closes, that equity's gone, right? It's not like the cash is in the company. It was used to buy the company. So the only risk dollars left inside the enterprise is that loan. And I think you also have a setup where the interests of the equity and the interests of the lenders may diverge pretty significantly because the equity may need to invest significantly in order to create a new moat in an AI world. And the lenders may say, I don't know that I want you to do that because it's got a high degree of uncertainty. And if you just run this business for cash, I think I can get repaid. Maybe you can, maybe you can. But that is going to create, I think, a lot of tension as we see this wave of, and I don't think it will be LMs like we saw in this past couple of years. It's going to be a lot more around, what do I do with the maturity in 2028, 2029, 2030? Do I extend 2, 3, 4 years? And what am I extending into? And what are the terms of that extension look like? As opposed to, I need a bunch of new money because the business is bleeding and I'm waiting for the cycle.
It's always hard to disprove a negative. We have 22 software bankers, Molus.
You're prepared.
Yeah, we brought over the team from SVP a couple of years back. And you know, we spent a lot of time with them. And one of the great things being a capital structure banker at Molus is I don't really need to know a ton about an industry. I have an industry partner. He's with me on every deal. I need to know my product. He knows his industry and we go at it and attack together. I think it's going to be very difficult to figure it out. This is going to be about time. These are tough businesses to kill, right? The cash flows are still recurring for until they're not. So I think this is going to be about a play for time. And I think what you heard between the lender point of view and the sponsor point of view is probably going to come to fruition.
And now if we step back a little bit from where the market is today, yeah. I'd love to spend a few minutes with you and ask you about your outlook, what could shape the next phase of restructurings without making any forecasts. What are you watching more closely as signals and that today's market is changing direction, both in terms of credit conditions or the pace of restructurings?
So I don't think what drives restructurings has really changed over my 25 years. It's what is economic sentiment and outlook look like? What is availability of capital look like? And where is the overall rate environment? And then industry specific wise, what disruptive factors are going to impact one industry or another? That's separate from sort of cyclicality, that is more structural. So we're all talking about software today. We could have been talking about telecom in 99 and 2000. We could have been talking about old media. That really was a great financial crisis, was the catalyst around a lot of those situations like newspapers, magazines, radio, television, et cetera. There's always technological disruption that is affecting one industry or another. That's always a little hard to forecast. We knew the answer to that. Again, we would be doing something else, but it's something you always want to keep an eye on. But then I think the broader macro factors are the same that they've always been.
I think there's a question of when the pushback against the documents is going to happen from the investors. This is not about what is the next industry to hit, what have you. I wonder if there's going to be technological changes as people try to, on the original investor side, push back against documents. I'm keeping an eye on that because I have heard some rumblings around that. I think that plus...
In the primary market, you mean, right?
Yeah. And that has obviously trickle-down effects.
Yeah.
I think that plus how lenders deal with the increasing process costs in the face of AI technology is going to be the two things that are interesting to me going forward, like a very macro perspective and how it affects our industry specifically. But then we're always going to have episodic issues. One question is, can this economy hold on long enough? Is it recession? How does that play out? Job loss? All those things
are... Interest rates staying higher.
Of course, all that some economists could probably come in here and rattle off. But from our industry, how structuring manifests is going to be, what's the setup of the documents, whether the capital structures change from this fat first lien layer to something else, and then what, if anything, is going to be done around process costs going forward?
I think the process cost point is a really important one because...
You talk about LME because we already know about Chapter 11 being pretty expensive. You're talking about the LME process?
No, I'm talking about Chapter 11.
Okay.
Because I think part of what has driven so many LMEs...
Is the cost cheaper, expensive.
It's cheaper to do an LM transaction than a Chapter 11.
Exactly.
And Chapter 11s have become so expensive that you now have people reaching for other alternatives, right? NFE used a UK restructuring plan. The idea that US companies would ever consider a form of restructuring implementation that wasn't Chapter 11 is shocking, right? That's because if you think Chapter 11 was always viewed in many ways as the poster child for how restructuring should take place because it was a rehabilitative process and not a foreclosure process, right? The criticisms of many other insolvency regimes was that they were not rehabilitative. They were more
liquidation mode process.
Correct. And so the fact that people have now looked at Chapter 11 and it's now, we should go find somewhere else to implement is staggering. And because there are such powerful tools available to companies and stakeholders in Chapter 11, I think the global automatic stay that is generally respected is such a powerful tool. The sophistication of DIP financing is such a powerful tool.
Rejecting leases and contracts.
There are things in Chapter 11 that are still way better than what you can do in other jurisdictions, although other jurisdictions have tried to copy some of the things in Chapter 11. But the costs are such that it is forcing people to either look elsewhere or to implement Chapter 11s in what I would call suboptimal ways because they don't want to incur the burn rate of staying in bankruptcy one day longer than they have to, even if it means you forego the optimization of the business as a result, and you'll say, I'll figure it out later, or I'll just live with the higher costs, or whatever it may be, because the offsetting process cost burden is so significant, and for the most part, has to be funded by the fulcrum security. From security is writing all those checks.
Let's get out quickly because you're eating up our recovery.
That goes back to the fat first thing layer, right? If it wasn't the fulcrum and it was just funding the dip,
right? They wouldn't.
Exactly. And so I think what's going to happen is eventually somewhere in the milieu, someone is going to put pressure on the process costs, and I don't know where it's going to come from yet.
I also started in 2010 covering this market, and there was no talk about Chapter 11 being expensive then at that point. People were not saying, oh, we're not going to file because it's expensive. There were a lot of filing, Peabody, TXU, Arch Coal, all the companies that just went through that process, Genon.
So Peabody I represent the same, but right, the dip lender wasn't the one who was wearing it's a different setup. Value was below at the end.
I have two more questions. If you were advising a sponsor or a board today of a stress company, stress, distress, what mindset would you encourage them to adopt heading into the next 12 to 24 months?
Flexibility. I think you have to be very thoughtful about understanding all of your options, because given all of the external events we have seen, it seems like it used to be one big external event every 5 years. It feels like we have one big external event every 6 weeks, right? We went from SaaSpocalypse to the Iran war, to the maybe the war's ending, to maybe the war not ending, to the disruption that we're all going to see from generative AI, to Venezuela. There's something that seems to be a big macro factor happening almost on a monthly basis. And so being flexible in your approach so that you don't get too anchored to any one path, so that you have the ability to change your approach as the facts on the ground change, I think is going to be very important. And then knowing how to balance the desire to be constructive and collaborative with your lenders while making sure you have alternatives away from them so they can't take advantage of you.
It's no different than it would have been 12 to 24 months ago, right? I want my clients to have a clear view of what their prioritizations are. Now, they can change that, but you want to have that list of, do I want term? Do I want liquidity? Do I want discount? Do I need something else? Asset sale, flexibility, whatever it may be, you have to have that. And that should be on your whiteboard. And keep thinking about those things, and then we'll find the right time to transact, but know what you want.
I'm curious on this note, what keeps restructuring intellectually interesting for you after all these years? It's a quick question, if you have a quick answer.
Yeah, I think it's just, for me, it's learning about new businesses and new industries and watching the deals evolve. It's not, you're not talking to the same 10 issuers about the same thing every day. It's like a different company, different industry every day.
I don't like knowing too much about the industries, to know an inch and nothing more. I think what keeps this interesting is going back to the culture for me, being part of a team success, having a team that and partners that I care about is interesting to me. And I think no one's ever going to hire me to go sell their company. It's not my DNA. It's not who I am. It's not what I do, right? It's not my personality. But I think this kind of fits with what I like to do, multi-party negotiation, games of strategy. That's what this all is. And if you can wrap that in a culture where you're winning alongside friends and teammates and a firm that has that mentality of going out and winning as a wolf pack, that's what does it for me. If it was just me, a solo shingle guy, I would probably have been gone a long time ago.
And finally, what advice would you give a young banker entering restructuring right now that you wish you had received earlier in your career?
Yeah, I think it's actually the same advice I did get earlier in my career. That's good. Which is, you got to be intellectually curious. You got to really care about what it is that you do. And you got to find ways to connect with people, because I think Barack said it earlier, ultimately, this is a business of trust. And it's very hard to trust someone you don't connect with. And so being someone people can connect with and can feel comfortable with is a really important attribute to have.
I was actually on a call with somebody today who was just starting out looking for advice. That's one of the things I like doing. It's kind of like the company with the prioritization, right? You got to prioritize what's important in your life and get to know what you're good at and see if you can cross with those prioritizations. And if it works, it's great. And if you're not built for it, go find something that you're built for. But I think finding out who you are, what you like, being in a
culture. I've used that word too much, but being a culture which you feel comfortable, which is going to bring the best out in you, is super important. And then you got to figure out if you like what you do. And if you can hit like all those check marks, congratulations, you won some kind of lottery. I'm not sure that this is the lottery payoff that we have, but you hit something. And so go with it. That would be my advice.
Thank you so much for everything. On this note, we're going to wrap up today's conversation. Thank you for your insights and for your perspectives.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks to everyone for listening. As always, you can subscribe or to download every episode on Apple or Spotify and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at thatwire.com.